Identify the main causes of your low self-confidence, excessive expectations, harsh self-judgment, preoccupation with fear, lack of experience, or lack of skill. Remember the confidence cycle. Practice the skills, apply them effectively, assess the results, and modify as needed. Does instant confidence really exist? There are many books, courses, and seminars that claim they can provide you with instant confidence, and instant confidence is a very good name for what they offer because it only lasts for an instant. What typically happens is that for a brief instant, while we are reading the book in the safety of our bedrooms, or listening to that CD in our cars, or participating in the buzz and drama of a seminar, we can conjure up those feelings of confidence. But as soon as we get into a real situation, stepping out of our comfort zones, facing a genuine challenge in real life, then all those wonderful feelings just evaporate. Poof, gone, vanished. And there's a very good reason for why this happens. To understand it, we need to go back in time to Chapter 2, The Good Old Days. It's coming for you. Thump, thump, thump. The ground beneath your feet is trembling. Thump, thump, thump. The beast raises its mighty trunk into the air and lets out a blood-curdling bellow. It's three times your height, covered with shaggy brown hair, has legs the size of tree trunks, and two enormous tusks protruding from its mouth. It's angry, and it's running at you. Thump, thump, thump. So, what happens next? You'll find out shortly. First, let's backtrack to the granddaddy of all those wrong rules for the confidence game. I have to feel confident before I do what matters. This rule seems to appeal to common sense because it's often much easier to take action and do the things that are important to you if you're already feeling confident. But clinging tightly to this belief means you will spend a lot of time, effort, and energy trying to control your feelings. And you will probably try very hard to eliminate feelings of fear, anxiety, and uncertainty, and replace them with those of calm, certainty, and assurance. Indeed, plenty of popular self-help books claim to show you just how to do that via positive affirmations, challenging negative thoughts, self-hypnosis, and so on. Unfortunately, it's just not that easy to control your feelings, and the farther you go down that road, the more likely you are to feel disappointed, frustrated, or hopeless. But please don't take my word for it. Check your own experience. Have you ever found a technique for controlling your feelings without using powerful drugs that works when you are in a truly challenging situation, stepping out of your comfort zone and facing your fears? Have you found a technique that enables you to feel total certainty and assurance under those conditions? This question is a setup. I know you haven't because it's impossible. There's no way to undo billions of years of evolution that have hardwired your body to respond to such challenging situations in a very specific manner, with something called the fight or flight response. To explain what this is, let's return to that mammoth. When a woolly mammoth is charging straight toward you, you really only have two options. Option one, run away, very, 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 very fast. Option two, stay your ground and fight, very, 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 very hard. Really, that's about it. Fight or flight. And note that both responses require lots of energy. In order to fight or take flight, you need power, strength, and stamina. Otherwise, you get squashed. Fortunately, thanks to hundreds of millions of years of evolution, your body will provide you with exactly what you need. When you face a threat, your body floods with adrenaline. Your reflexes become faster, your muscles tense for action, your focus sharpens, and your heart pumps extra blood to the parts of your body that need it most, primarily the large muscles of your arms and legs. We call this amazing reaction the fight-or-flight response. Technically speaking, it's the fight-flight-or-freeze response, because sometimes we freeze instead of fleeing or fighting. But for the sake of simplicity, we'll stick to the shorter version. All mammals, as well as fish, reptiles, and birds, have a fight-or-flight response. It is immediate and automatic. Essential for survival, it activates the moment you perceive a threat. It prepares you to fight off the threat or take flight from it, whichever is most likely to save your life. Suppose your primitive ancestor, facing that charging woolly mammoth, did not have such a response. Suppose they just stood there, watching and waiting, marvelling at the beauty and majesty of the charging behemoth. He or she soon would have been very flat. Now, let's imagine you're part of a group of our cave-dwelling ancestors living together in a happy little prehistoric valley. And let's suppose that life is good in that valley. You know where the food is, you know where the water is, you know who your neighbours are, and you know where the dangerous animals are, so you can keep well away from them. But you also know full well that you can't stay in your happy little valley all the time. Every so often, you'll need to go out looking for food. Whenever the food supplies run low, you get together with your neighbours and set off over the mountain to see if you can bag a woolly mammoth for dinner. But this is no small undertaking. You're taking a significant risk. The farther you travel from your old familiar territory, the more danger you're in. After all, there are big animals out there, with big claws and big teeth. Animals that would love nothing more than to have a puny, hairless ape for a lunchtime snack. So you need to be on the lookout, alert for saber-toothed tigers, hungry cave bears, and rival clans. At the slightest hint of a threat, a sudden movement in the bushes, an odd smell in the air, a strange shadow on the horizon, your fight-or-flight response kicks in. Your heart races, you flood with adrenaline, your muscles tense. This is a good thing. Now you're ready to fight or take flight. And if it turns out to be a false alarm, no problem. After a while, in the absence of any threat, the response will cease. Your adrenaline levels will come down, your heart rate will drop, and you'll feel more relaxed. Things haven't changed all that much since those ancestral days. Sure, life is a bit easier, and there's much less risk of being eaten, gored, or stomped on by big animals, but we still have to take risks. If we want to grow and develop as human beings, we have to step out of our old familiar territory and venture into the unknown. And we will have to do this not just once, but again and again. And each time we leave that familiar territory, popularly known as the comfort zone, our fight-or-flight response will be triggered. Now, this is completely natural. Each time you leave your comfort zone to enter a challenging new situation, you are taking a significant risk. After all, there's no assurance that things will turn out the way you want. The inconvenient truth is that bad things can happen. No one can guarantee that they won't. You might fail, or get hurt, or screw it up, or make a fool of yourself. You might be rejected or lose all your money or waste time and effort ending up with nothing to show for it. And the greater the step you take outside of your comfort zone, the greater the challenge you face, the more uncertainty there is about the outcome. Under these circumstances, there is no way that you will be able to switch off your fight or flight response, no way to instill yourself with feelings of absolute certainty and assurance. That is, apart from using drugs with dangerous side effects. Of course, in everyday language, we don't usually talk about the fight-or-flight response. You've probably never heard someone say, "I'm giving a talk in front of 200 people next week, and I'm having a fight-or-flight response." You're far more likely to hear talk of fear or nervousness. What's in a name? Fear has many different names. Here are a few of the more common ones. Lack of confidence, anxiety, self-doubt, insecurity, nerves, cold feet, stressing out. I've worked with CEOs, soldiers, police officers, lawyers, and surgeons who initially refused to admit to having fear or anxiety because they saw these emotions as a personal failing or a sign of weakness. They could admit to being stressed, tense, wired, or having a crisis of confidence, but not to being anxious or afraid. This is hardly surprising. In almost every human culture, fear is demonized as a sign of personal weakness, especially in men. And in our society, the brainwashing starts very young. Think about it. When you were a little kid and you were feeling frightened, what kinds of unhelpful things did adults say to you? And in the process, what messages did they send you about fear? For example, did you ever hear, "Don't be silly, there's nothing to be afraid of," or "Don't be stupid, there's no such thing as ghosts or monsters or vampires"? The message here is, feeling afraid means being silly or stupid. Maybe you heard some of these, "Don't be such a baby," "Grow up," or "Act your age." And suppose you were so scared you actually started to cry, then you may have heard, "Don't be a crybaby," "Don't be a sissy," "Big boys don't cry." The message here is that fear equals immaturity or weakness. Furthermore, these messages are powerfully reinforced by pop culture. In virtually every book, comic, movie, or TV series, the heroes and heroines are fearless. Indiana Jones, Charlie's Angels, James Bond, Wonder Woman, Superman, Batman, they have no fear. Okay, occasionally, just occasionally, they do reveal a tiny glimpse of it. For example, I do remember one James Bond movie where you actually saw a few droplets of sweat on his forehead. The film was Dr. No, and the scene I'm thinking of had Sean Connery strapped to a table, legs akimbo, and a laser beam was about to slice his testicles off. So in that situation, he was allowed to have a bit of sweat on his forehead. But when the whole world is about to blow up, all he does is smile and crack a joke. With all of this conditioning going on, it's hardly surprising we grow up with a negative attitude toward fear. This is a great shame because, as we'll see later in the book, fear is like a powerful fuel. Once we know how to handle it, we can use it to our advantage. We can harness its energy to help us get where we want to go. But while we're looking at fear as something bad, we'll waste a lot of precious energy trying to avoid or get rid of it. Now, once again, pause for a moment and for 10 seconds, notice what your mind is telling you. So, is your mind on board for the ride, eager to find out more, or is it saying, "This guy's full of it. Clearly I bought the wrong book. This isn't what I wanted to hear"? Whatever your mind is saying is fine by me. I fully expect that as you keep reading, there will be times when your mind is very enthusiastic and other times when it will be very skeptical and critical. That's just what minds do. So see if you can let your mind chatter away like a voice on a radio playing in the background and carry on working through the book. And see if you can stay open to the reality that you will not develop true confidence in either sense of the word by trying to eliminate fear, nerves, or anxiety. However, you will develop true confidence in both senses of the word once you learn how to change your relationship to fear and use it to your advantage. But before we get to that point, there's a little more myth-busting to be done. And what better way to start than with a game of Chapter 3, True or False? Ready for a little quiz? Please answer true or false to each of the following statements. 1. Albert Einstein was a below-average school student. 2. You only use 10% of your brain. 3. Positive self-statements such as "I will succeed" or "I am lovable" are a good way to boost low self-esteem. Most people answer true for most or all of these statements. This is only to be expected. After all, countless books, TV programs, and articles on self-improvement tell you these things as if they were hard facts. They tell you Einstein did poorly at school. The message, if Einstein could go on to such greatness despite his early failures, then so can you. They tell you that you use just 10% of your brain. The message, imagine what you could achieve if you used all of your brain. They tell you that positive self-statements will give you high self-esteem. The message, it's easy to eliminate negative self-talk. As you may have guessed from my tone, all these widely known, frequently quoted facts are actually false. Yes, Einstein did do poorly in French in his early teen years, but overall he was a good student, excelling in math and physics, and his marks in all subjects averaged more than 80% in his final year at school. As for only using 10% of your brain, this idea started in the early 1900s, but has been popularized in the past 50 years. Yet despite the fact that thousands of self-development programs quote this fact, you will never see one shred of hard scientific evidence to support it. And that is because it is complete and utter nonsense. Scientists have studied the brain extensively in a myriad of different ways, from MRI and PET scans to examination under a microscope. And guess what? They have never located one single part of the brain that is redundant. Every part of it serves a function, and you use 100% of it every day. If a stroke, tumor, disease, or injury destroys even a tiny percentage of the brain, this usually results in significant disability. And what about positive affirmations? Chances are, You've read or been told that if you're experiencing self-doubt or low self-esteem or generally lacking confidence in yourself, then the solution is to think positive things about yourself over and over until you believe them. Have you ever tried doing this? If so, did it work for you? Or did you find that it just caused your mind to get into an argument with itself? While motivational speakers and self-help gurus love to espouse the benefits of positive affirmations, and the concept certainly appeals to common sense, there is no scientific evidence to show it works. In fact, science suggests the very opposite. In 2009, a team of Canadian psychologists, Joanne V. Wood and John W. Lee from the University of Waterloo, and W.Q. Elaine Perunovich from the University of New Brunswick, published a groundbreaking study in Psychological Science magazine, which is ranked among the top 10 psychology journals in the world. Their study, entitled Positive Self-Statements, Power for Some, Peril for Others, made world headlines. Why? Because it showed that people with low self-esteem actually feel worse after repeating positive self-statements such as I am a lovable person or I will succeed. Rather than being helpful, these positive thoughts typically triggered a strong negative reaction and a resultant low mood. For example, if a participant with low self-esteem said to herself, I am a lovable person, her mind would answer back, no, you're not, and run through a list of all the ways in which she was not lovable. Not surprisingly, this would make her feel even worse than before. On the other hand, when these participants were told it was okay to have negative thoughts about themselves, their moods lifted. So what's all this got to do with confidence? Well, the connection is a bit oblique, but it does demonstrate the fact that we're all full of it. Hopefully you're starting to see that we all walk around with our heads full of inaccurate and misleading information. Confession, I too once believed all the above myths. We are all too ready to believe all sorts of seemingly common sense ideas without stopping to question their origin or validity. And this is especially so in the realm of pop psychology. It's important to keep this in mind, because if we hold on tightly to these ideas, they can create all sorts of problems for us. As the great writer Mark Twain put it, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble, it's what you know for sure that just ain't so. So, with this in mind, let's quickly review four widely held beliefs. Fear is a sign of weakness, fear impairs performance, fear holds you back, and confidence is the absence of fear. Myth: fear is a sign of weakness. Do you buy into this idea? Then let me quote a couple of people whom you could hardly call weak. Legendary long-distance cyclist Lance Armstrong, one of the greatest athletes of all time, and blockbuster movie star Hugh Jackman, whose rippling muscles cause both men and women to swoon. I fear failure. I have a huge phobia around failure. Lance Armstrong. I've always felt that if you back down from a fear, the ghost of that fear never goes away. It diminishes people. So I've always said yes to the thing I'm most scared about. Hugh Jackman. Now, stop reading and for a few seconds notice what your mind is telling you. So did you hear your mind protest with something like this? Yes, but it's different for them. I'm not competing in the Tour de France or starring in Hollywood movies, so I shouldn't be afraid. If your mind did tell you something like that, it's hardly surprising. It takes time to fully assimilate the information about the fight-or-flight response that we discussed in the previous chapter. The fact is, every normal human being experiences this response when they step out of their comfort zone into a challenging situation. This is not a sign of weakness, but a sign of normality. If you don't experience this response when you take a risk, face a challenge, or leave your comfort zone, it means one of two things. A, there's something seriously wrong with your brain, or B, you're a fictitious character like James Bond. Now, the size and shape of your comfort zone is inevitably going to be different from that of Armstrong or Jackman, or that of your parents or your children or your next-door neighbor's mother-in-law. That's a given. We're all individuals, but no matter how big or how small your comfort zone is, it's a fact that the moment you leave it, you're going to have a fight-or-flight response. And the greater the step you take, the stronger the response, and the greater the fear you'll experience. At the risk of repeating myself, when you step out of your comfort zone, take a risk, or face a challenge, you will feel fear. That's not weakness, it's the natural state of affairs for normal human beings. Now, as you work through this book, I expect your comfort zone to expand. And as this happens, where you once struggled with fear, anxiety, and self-doubt, you are likely to be much more at ease and able to engage fully in what you are doing without an ongoing battle with your thoughts and feelings. But there's no way to expand your comfort zone without stepping out of it. And the moment you take that step, fear is going to show up. Myth: fear impairs performance. Talk to a few top athletes, movie stars, public speakers, musicians, or other stage performers, and you'll soon discover this is not true. When performers put themselves out there in the public arena, the indisputable fact is that they are taking a risk. No matter how accomplished they are, no matter how much their fans love them, no matter how successful they've been in the past, there's always the chance that this time they could screw it up. The fact is, they face a genuinely challenging situation that taxes their skills and abilities. And when any human being takes a risk and faces a genuinely challenging situation, what do they experience? That's right, a fight or flight response. However, top performers rarely refer to this response as fear, anxiety, or nerves. They are more likely to call it being pumped, revved up, or amped, or having an adrenaline rush. When people use words such as these, rather than words like fear or anxiety, then they have discovered the following very important truth. Fear is not your enemy. It is a powerful source of energy that can be harnessed and used for your benefit. Most top performers instinctively know this. They learn how to channel their fear and anxiety into their performance. And in doing so, the quality of their performance increases. This may sound hard to believe, but later in the book, you'll learn how to do this yourself. Myth: fear holds you back. This is really a variant of the last two myths. The story is that fear somehow holds you back from achieving what you want in life. Luckily, this isn't the case. What holds you back is not fear, but your attitude toward it. The tighter you hold on to the attitude that fear is something bad, and that you can't do the things you want until it goes away, the more stuck you will be. In fact, that very attitude, that fear is something bad, will not only keep you stuck, but it will actually increase your fear. It leads to fear about your fear, anxiety about your anxiety, nerves about your nerves. Indeed, this attitude plays a major role in all common anxiety disorders, from panic disorder to social phobia. I mentioned earlier that top performers learn to accept their fear and channel it into their performance. However, occasionally a performer buys into the idea that fear is bad, and the moment they adopt that attitude, they develop stage fright. All of a sudden, their fear becomes a serious problem, a major obstacle, something they struggle with. And generally, the more they struggle with it, the worse it gets. The simple fact is this. It is not fear that holds people back. It is their attitude toward it that keeps them stuck. Some performers struggle with their fear so much that they even start taking drugs or cancelling their performances, or both, hoping to make it go away. But this is futile. To quote Eleanor Roosevelt, "You gain strength, courage, and confidence by every experience in which you really stop to look fear in the face. The danger lies in refusing to face the fear and not daring to come to grips with it." Myth: confidence is the absence of fear. The story goes that confident people don't feel anxious or afraid. This is simply not so. Refer back to the first two myths. The fact is, in a challenging situation, even the most confident people on the planet experience fear. However, when you know how to handle it effectively, it does not destroy your confidence. This gives us the second rule of the confidence game. Rule 2. Genuine confidence is not the absence of fear, it is a transformed relationship with fear. In summary, in the next section of the book, we're going to knuckle down to the real work, learning and practicing the skills that will enable you to transform your relationship with fear and develop genuine confidence. But before we finish, here's a quick recap of the main points in this chapter. Key points. When you step out of your comfort zone, take a risk, or face a challenge, you will feel fear. That's not weakness, it's the normal state of affairs for normal human beings. Fear is not your enemy, it is a powerful source of energy that can be harnessed and used for your benefit. It is not fear that holds people back, it is their attitude toward fear that keeps them stuck. Genuine confidence is not the absence of fear, it is a transformed relationship with fear. So, are you ready to fundamentally transform your relationship with fear, to stop regarding it as an enemy and turn it into a powerful source of energy? Then the first step is learning how to handle that double-edged sword, the mind. Part 2, The Double-Edged Sword. Chapter 4, It Ain't Necessarily So. What's it like for you? Is it like a voice inside your head? You'll fail. You don't have what it takes. You'll get rejected. You'll screw it up. It could all go horribly wrong, or you're not ready for it yet. Better put it off until later. Or is it more like a sensation in your body? Churning stomach, clenched teeth, tight throat, pounding heart, restless legs, tense muscles, tight chest, difficulty breathing, dry mouth, sweaty hands. Whatever you prefer to call it, lack of confidence, fear of failure, anxiety, nerves, or tension, it boils down to a few basic elements which are described by psychologists as private experiences because they are experiences that only you know about. The most common private experiences that the human brain and nervous system emits are these. E. Emotions. M. Memories. I. Images. T. Thoughts. S. Sensations. So usually when someone talks about a lack of self-confidence, they are referring to some of the following. Emotions such as fear and anxiety, memories of past failures or mistakes, images, that is, mental pictures of things going badly, thoughts about failure, disaster, doing it wrong, not being good enough or giving up, sensations such as a racing heart, dry mouth, or butterflies in the stomach. In this book, for the sake of simplicity, I am going to lump all these private experiences into two categories. Memories, thoughts, and images I will simply refer to as thoughts. Emotions and sensations I will call feelings. And when I use the term thoughts and feelings, I mean every private experience a human has. Emotions, memories, images, thoughts, and sensations. Now, to develop lasting confidence, we need to know three things. 1. How to handle our thoughts and feelings effectively. 2. How to take control of our actions, even when our thoughts and feelings are negative or uncomfortable. 3. How to engage fully in whatever we are doing, irrespective of the thoughts and feelings we are having. I'm going to leave feelings until later in the book, because they're easier to deal with once we can handle our thoughts. So let's begin by considering. What are thoughts? Thoughts are words and pictures inside our head. Psychologists' technical term for thought is cognition. There are many different categories of thoughts, including memories, images, fantasies, beliefs, ideas, attitudes, assumptions, values, goals, plans, visions, dreams, desires, predictions, judgments, and so on. But no matter how complex our thoughts may be, they are all constructed from two basic building blocks, words and images. Check this out for yourself. When you get to the end of this paragraph, stop reading for 1 minute, close your eyes, and simply notice what your mind is doing. You should notice either some words, which you hear, like a voice, or see, like writing, or some pictures, or a combination of both. If your mind goes blank, just wait. It won't take long before your mind says something like, "I'm not having any thoughts," which is, of course, a thought. Please try this now for 1 minute. So what did you notice? What did your mind have to say to or show you? If you noticed sensations or feelings in your body as opposed to words and pictures in your head, I would not call those thoughts. I'd call them sensations or feelings. We'll deal with them later. You've undoubtedly noticed that your mind is very good at generating words and pictures. Consider for a moment, how many thoughts does your mind create in the space of just one day? Hundreds upon thousands, if not millions. And it never runs out, does it? It's always show-and-tell time for the mind. It's always got something to say or something to show us. And you've undoubtedly also noticed that your mind has a tendency to be negative. As I said in Chapter 1, that's perfectly natural and normal. The human mind is quick to judge, criticize, compare, point out what's not good enough, and tell us what needs to be improved. And although our culture bombards us with messages about the importance of positive thinking, the simple fact is this: the human mind has evolved to think negatively. To understand why this is, let's return to our primitive ancestors. Most scientists agree that our species, Homo sapiens, appeared around 100,000 years ago. In those days, we had four basic needs: food, water, shelter, and sex. Not all at the same time, mind you, gets a bit messy. But none of these things is important if you're dead. So, back then, the number one job that your mind had to do, better than any other job, was to keep you from getting killed. So how does a mind do that? It looks around for danger. It constantly scans the environment, trying to spot or anticipate anything that can possibly hurt you. 100,000 years ago, if your mind was not very good at doing this job, then you didn't live very long. Bears, wolves, saber-toothed tigers, woolly mammoths, avalanches, volcanoes, rival tribes, and jealous neighbors, there was no shortage of painful or violent ways to die. So, if there ever was an early human who went through life in a fearless and carefree manner, only noticing all the good things around them, thinking positively that nothing would ever go wrong, they would have been eaten, trampled, or murdered pretty quickly, long before they had a chance to reproduce. You and I evolved from the cavemen and cavewomen who were always on the lookout, always alert for danger, always prepared for the worst. So our modern brains are always trying to anticipate what could hurt us or harm us, always trying to predict what might go wrong. No wonder we all have so many doubts, worries, concerns, and fears of failure. This is not a sign of a weak or defective mind. It's a perfectly natural byproduct of evolution. And that is why, even if we diligently practice positive thinking every single day of our lives, we can't stop our minds from generating negative thoughts. Many people are surprised to hear this. After all, our society bombards us with messages about the importance of positive thinking. There is even a popular brand of bottled water that says on the label, "Drink positive, think positive." Please, give us a break. Can't we even drink some water in peace without being hassled about how we think? Unfortunately, what these books, articles, and courses on positive thinking often fail to mention is that although we can learn to think a bit more positively, that won't stop negative thoughts from arising. Anything you've read in self-help books about erasing old mental tapes or deleting old programs or eliminating negative core beliefs is stuff and nonsense. The latest discoveries in the world of neuroscience make it clear that the brain does not eliminate or eradicate old neural pathways. Rather, it lays down new ones on top of the old ones. The more you use these new neural pathways, the more habitual your new patterns of thinking will become. But those old neural pathways will not disappear. Those old patterns of thinking will not vanish. It's a bit like cutting a new path through a forest. The more the new pathway is used, the more established it becomes. But the old path doesn't cease to exist. If it gets used less often, the grass may grow over it to some degree, but it's still there and easily reclaimed. The problem with this analogy is that it is easy to stop using an old pathway in a forest. It's a billion times harder to stop using an old pathway in your brain. So here's another analogy that might be better. When you practice new types of thinking, it's like learning to speak a new language, but no matter how fluent you become in the new language, your old language doesn't disappear. No matter how well you learn to speak Spanish, you won't lose the ability to speak English. The greatest Zen master in the land. When it comes to training the mind to perform at its peak, Zen masters are the equivalent of Olympic athletes. So it's worth heeding this ancient Zen parable. One day in the monastery, a novice approaches the head monk and says, "Master, how do I find the greatest Zen master in the whole land?" The head monk scratches his head and thinks for a moment. Then he says, Find the person who tells you he or she has eliminated all negative thoughts, and if you find such a person, you'll know that's not who you're looking for. In other words, even the greatest Zen masters have negative thoughts, and so do the greatest positive psychologists. The world-famous psychologist Martin Seligman provides a good example. Seligman, the author of hugely successful books such as Learned Optimism and Authentic Happiness, is widely referred to as the father of positive psychology. One of the many things I admire about him is his honesty. He admits that even though he has spent the last 20 years teaching people all around the world to think optimistically, as soon as he finds himself in a challenging situation, the first thing that pops into his head is a pessimistic thought. Now, just stop reading for 20 seconds and notice what your mind is telling you. Is your mind protesting, arguing, or criticizing, or is it relieved to know that you're normal? Is it perhaps excited and curious about what comes next? Or is it worried that I'm going to tell you that this is your lot in life and you have to just put up with it? Please let your mind say whatever it wants. You'll have noticed it's always got an opinion. Of course, at times those opinions are useful, but at other times they're extremely unhelpful. Which is why, in ACT, we say, the mind is a double-edged sword. Our minds are pretty amazing. They help us plan for the future and learn from the past. They help us analyze our world and generate useful guidelines for living and thriving. They enable us to communicate, negotiate, and contribute, to innovate, improve, and invent, to be creative and adaptive. That's the bright side. The dark side of the mind is that it's quick to criticize and judge harshly. It conjures up scary stories about the future and dredges up painful memories from the past. It reminds us of our flaws, faults, and failures, and compares us unfavorably to others. And there is nothing abnormal or defective about any of this. These are all the ordinary processes of a normal human mind. Later in the book, we'll look at how to use the bright side of the mind, how to clarify our values, set goals, and think strategically to help us with motivation and commitment. But in this section, we're going to focus on the dark side, on handling all those inevitable negative thoughts. And if you're wondering, are they really inevitable? Well, let's see. The pop-up thoughts exercise. Here's a little exercise invented by Stephen Hayes. I'm about to give you three well-known phrases, but in each case the last word is missing. As you read the incomplete sentences, notice what words automatically pop into your head. This is not a quiz. I don't want you to guess the answers. I want you to simply notice what pops into your head without any effort at all. Here goes. Children should be seen and not. Mary had a little. Blondes have more. So, what happened? If you grew up in the United States, United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, or New Zealand, speaking English as your first language, then the words that probably popped into your head were herd, lamb, and fun. So do you really believe that children should be seen and not heard? Or that there really was a girl called Mary who had a little lamb that followed her to school? Or that blondes really do have more fun than people of other hair colours? I'm betting the answer in each case is no. So now suppose I told you to eliminate all of those word sequences from your mind. Eradicate them, so that under no circumstances do those specific sequences of words ever pop up again inside your head. Could you do that? Maybe with science fiction brain surgery, but otherwise they are deeply implanted in your mind. We can pretty much guarantee that in a context where someone says, Mary had a little, the word lamb will pop up inside your head. Your mind is full of this stuff. Let's try a few more. Read the following sentences and notice the words your brain supplies automatically. Every cloud has a. Diamonds are a girl's. Plenty more fish in. You only use 10% of. Just as the word lamb pops up when we encounter the phrase Mary had a little, negative thoughts will pop up whenever we encounter a genuinely challenging situation. Like it or not, as soon as we even think about stepping out of our comfort zones, our minds are likely to tell us those same old stories, the ones they've been telling us ever since we were young. You know the ones I mean. You'll fail, or you'll screw it up, or it'll go wrong, or you're not ready, or you're not good enough, or it's too hard, and so on. We can bundle all these thoughts up into one big story. I can't do it. In chapter one, I mentioned Claire, the somewhat shy 33-year-old receptionist who hasn't been out on a date in more than 4 years. Her version of the I can't do it story was, I can't start dating because I don't know how to talk to guys. I get so nervous, I just clam up. I also mentioned Raj, the successful businessman who wanted to open up a second restaurant. His version of the story was, I can't do it because I might fail and lose a lot of money. Then there was Dave, the physiotherapist who dreamed of writing novels. His story was short and sweet. I can't write. There was also Alexis, the mother of two, who wanted to stand up to her domineering, hypocritical mother-in-law. Alexis's version went, I can't do it because it's too scary. I don't know how she'll react. And for one last example, let's revisit Seb, the taxi driver, who avoided making love to his wife. His version of the story was, I can't do it because it's too embarrassing. I'm too scared it might happen again. Over the past 5 years, I've spoken on this topic to thousands of people in Australia, the United Kingdom, the United States, and Europe, to widely varying audiences, including doctors, lawyers, police officers, business executives, CEOs, psychologists, counselors, therapists, coaches, psychiatrists, athletes, entrepreneurs, and parents' groups. And I always ask this question: is there anyone in this room who can honestly put their hand up and say that they do not have some version of the I can't do it story? So far, not one single person has ever raised their hand. So if you can't stop your mind from telling you the I can't do it story, then what are you supposed to do when this story shows up? The three most common solutions you'll encounter are A, challenge or dispute the thoughts and look for evidence to prove they're not true, B, replace them with more positive thoughts, and C, distract yourself from the thoughts. Now, you may like to try these things out if you've never done so before. However, given that these solutions are the ones that almost everyone will suggest to you, I expect you've already tried them. And if you have tried them, you've undoubtedly recognized that A, they require a lot of effort and energy, B, even if they do give you temporary relief from negative thoughts, your mind just keeps on coming up with new ones. And C, when you leave your comfort zone to enter a genuinely challenging situation, these techniques don't help you very much. You may even have found, as in the research I mentioned before, that trying to think positively made you feel worse. So what's the alternative? If you're familiar with ACT, you know what's coming. But if you're not, you're probably wondering, so what am I supposed to do then? Am I just supposed to ignore these thoughts, or grit my teeth and put up with them, or try to push them away, or try to distract myself from them? Personally, I wouldn't recommend any of these strategies. Again, I'm willing to bet you've already tried doing these things. They are common sense approaches that almost everyone tries at some point. And if you have, you probably found that even if they gave you some short-term benefits, they didn't, in the long run, give you an empowering and life-enhancing way of dealing effectively with negative thoughts. Therefore, you're going to learn a radically different way of responding to negative thoughts, something that will go against almost everything you have been taught growing up in our society. But first, let's consider a very important question. Are negative thoughts really a problem? How many times have you heard or read, or perhaps even told someone else, that negative thoughts are bad, problematic, harmful, or self-defeating? That you shouldn't be thinking that way? That winners think positively and losers think negatively? That negative thinking will hold you back? That happy people don't have those kinds of thoughts? That thinking that way will give you poor self-esteem or low self-confidence? Chances are people have been engraving these ideas into your brain ever since you were a toddler. You've heard them over and over from parents, teachers, self-help books, friends, health professionals, TV programs, newspapers, and magazines. The most extreme version takes the line that your negative thoughts are so harmful that they will actually manifest in reality. They will actually come true. Interesting proposition. Let's look at it a bit more closely. You may be familiar with a common anxiety disorder called OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. Sufferers have recurrent negative thoughts many times a day. They imagine or worry that all sorts of really bad things will happen. I'll get AIDS, my house will burn down, or my children will die. OCD sufferers are very distressed by these thoughts and are often totally convinced that they will come true. But people start to recover from OCD when they realize that these thoughts will not actually come true. OCD sufferers have typically had these negative thoughts many thousands, if not millions of times, totally and utterly believing them, and yet they have never manifested in reality. Another common idea is that negative thoughts are problematic because our thoughts control our actions. If this were true, the human race would be in big trouble. After all, how often have you gotten so mad at somebody you care about that you thought about hurting them in some way? Yelling at them, shaking them, leaving them, or getting back at them. Be honest with yourself, we all have these thoughts at times. Now just imagine if those thoughts had actually controlled you, if you had actually gone and done all those hurtful things, what would have happened to your closest relationships? Would you still have any friends left? And have you ever thought about quitting, yet persisted? Have you ever thought of running away, but stayed and stuck it out? Clearly our thoughts don't control our actions. They certainly influence what we do, but they do not control what we do. And you'll soon discover how you can quickly reduce the influence of your negative thoughts without even trying to get rid of them. There is now a wealth of scientific studies published in top, peer-reviewed psychology journals that show acceptance and commitment therapy helps people to build rich, meaningful lives even in the face of serious conditions such as depression, schizophrenia, drug addiction, and anxiety disorders. And in the worlds of business and sport, acceptance and commitment training gets similar results, reducing stress, increasing fulfillment, and enhancing performance. And yet ACT makes no effort whatsoever to reduce, challenge, eliminate, or change negative thoughts. Why not? Because ACT starts from the assumption that negative thoughts are not inherently problematic. Now, once again, just pause for 10 seconds and notice what your mind is saying. So what did you hear? Something like, that can't be right. Is he serious? I'm not buying it. Or was it more like, wow, that's interesting. Whatever your mind is telling you, it's absolutely fine by me. Just let it chatter away as if it's a radio playing in the background and keep on reading. To pick up where we left off, ACT assumes that negative thoughts are not inherently problematic. Negative thoughts only become problematic if we get all caught up in them, give them all our attention, treat them as the gospel truth, allow them to control us, or get into a fight with them. The technical term for responding to our thoughts in this way is fusion. Why fusion? Well, think of two sheets of metal fused together. If you couldn't use the word fused, how would you describe them? Stuck, welded, bonded, melded, joined. These words all carry the same message. There is no separation between the sheets of metal. Similarly, when I talk about being fused with your thoughts, I mean there is no separation from them. In a state of fusion, we are completely entangled by our thoughts. We are caught up in them, pushed around by them, lost in them, or fighting with them. In other words, when we fuse with our thoughts, they have a huge impact on and influence over us. But when we defuse from our thoughts, when we separate from them and realize that they are nothing more nor less than words and pictures, then they have little or no effect on us, even if they happen to be true. But don't take my word for it. In the next chapter, you will discover for yourself that no matter how negative our thoughts are, they do not have to become problematic. When we know how to defuse from them, they lose their impact on and influence over us. They do not hold us back from being who we want to be or doing what we want to do. You will discover that there is no need to fight with them, challenge them, suppress them, push them away, dwell on them, or allow them to control you. All you need do is learn how to get yourself. Chapter 5, Off the Hook. Joe Simpson was freezing cold and in terrible agony. His right leg was broken, the knee completely shattered, and his climbing partner had left him for dead at the bottom of a huge crevasse. He did not believe he was going to make it out alive. He had no food, water, or fuel for a fire. He was lying on a bridge of ice, stranded on a deserted mountain in the Peruvian Andes. His climbing partner, convinced that Joe was dead, had gone back to base camp without him. And yet, against all the odds, Joe managed to crawl out of the crevasse, dragging his mangled leg behind him, and make his way back to base camp. Although it was only 6 miles away, it took him 3 agonizing days to hop and crawl that distance. You may know Joe's story from his awe-inspiring book, Touching the Void. One thing that struck me was that throughout his ordeal, Joe was bombarded by negative thoughts. He didn't have a head full of positive thoughts, such as, I will make it no matter what. The odds were so overwhelmingly against him that he naturally believed he was going to die. But he did not let those thoughts stop him. He kept taking action, hauling his body inch by inch through the snow, even while his mind told him it was futile, that he was as good as dead, and that he might as well give up. Joe's story serves as a powerful reminder that negative thoughts need not hold us back. We don't have to wait until we're feeling all positive and optimistic. We can take action, even if our minds say we can't. Try this right now. Think to yourself, over and over, I can't lift my arm. I can't lift my arm. And as you're thinking it, lift your arm up. Please do this now before reading on. So there you go. You can lift your arm up, even when your mind says that you can't. When I do this exercise in groups, I notice that many people hesitate for a second or two before they lift their arm up, and occasionally someone even takes a good 10 or 15 seconds. This is because we're used to taking our minds literally, to believing everything they tell us. Fortunately, we can learn to break this habit. We can learn how to do the things that really matter, even when our minds say it's not possible. We can learn the art of getting off the hook. Have you ever seen a fish struggling to escape from a fishing line? No matter how hard it tries, its struggles are futile. Once it has swallowed that hook, it has no capacity to unhook itself. In ACT, rather than using the technical term fusion, we often talk about getting hooked by our thoughts. Our minds throw us thought after thought, inviting us to take the bait. And if we bite, we get hooked. We get all tangled up in our thoughts, and they exert a major influence over our actions. Fortunately, we can readily learn to unhook ourselves, that is, defuse from our thoughts. And in this chapter, I'm going to take you through a range of simple techniques to show you how. But first, let's identify the types of thoughts that tend to hook us, all the various bits and pieces of the I can't do it story that can so easily drag us away from doing what matters. What's hooking you? When you start thinking about making important changes, about being the person you want to be and doing the things you want to do, what sorts of things does your mind tend to say to you? Does it turn into a cheerleader and start singing some rousing, motivational song, such as, go for it, you can do it, knuckle on down and just get to it. It's so easy, do it now, you've got the power, kazam, kapow. I'm guessing that if you're anything like me, or the hundreds of clients I've worked with over the years, then about the only time your mind turns into a cheerleader is when your personal challenges are a long way off. Yes, I'll start it next year. Easy. However, when you're staring that challenge directly in the face, it's a different story, isn't it? Let me give you a peek into my world. As I'm writing the first draft of this chapter, early in the morning on a Saturday, I'm feeling a strong urge to quit. I am not in the mood for this. I'm feeling spectacularly unmotivated, and I'm sorely tempted right now to stop writing and go and surf the internet, or answer some email, or play with my son, or snack on a cookie, or make a cup of tea. In other words, I want to do anything but write. My mind keeps saying things like, this is so boring. I'm not in the mood. It's too hard. I'll do it later. It's so warm and sunny outside. Why not go for a walk? Your writing really sucks. This book's going to flop if you can't make it more interesting for your readers. Why don't you take a break and come back to it later? Now, what would happen if I were to get hooked by these thoughts? There are 2 likely outcomes. A, I'd stop writing, or B, I'd keep on plugging away, but instead of being focused and engaged in what I'm doing, I'd be all caught up in my thoughts, which would not only make writing difficult, but also impair the quality. As it happens, both of these outcomes have happened to me many times, and sometimes they still do. You see, despite my best intentions, my mind still knows how to hook me. But the good news is, the more I practice, the better I get at unhooking myself, and the freer I am to do what truly matters to me. And that's why I am now writing my third book in under 2 years. Believe me, if I had waited until my mind stopped being negative, then to this day I would not have written a word. Do you ever get hooked by thoughts a bit like mine? What effect does that have on you? Does it interfere with your performance or hold you back from doing what you want to do? If so, good. That shows you're a normal human being, because that's what usually happens when people get hooked. Below are some of the more common thoughts that hook us and pull us away from achieving what we want. Which ones does your mind bait you with? Add in any of your own that may be missing. I've got no motivation. I've got no discipline. I've got no willpower. I'm too busy. I'm too tired. I don't have time. I don't have the energy. I'll start next week. I'll fail. It's a waste of time. I'll make a fool of myself. I don't have what it takes. I'm not ready. It's too hard. I need more practice. I need to read some more books about it. I need more equipment. Other people don't have to go through this. It shouldn't be this difficult. I'm too anxious. And every time I've tried to change, I've always failed, so why should it be any different this time? I could easily fill up several more pages with thoughts and beliefs of this nature. Our minds are truly brilliant at coming up with reasons why we can't do what really matters to us. Thus, in ACT, we refer to all such thoughts as reason-giving. There are many different categories of reason-giving, but here are the four most common. 1. Obstacles. Our minds point out all the obstacles and difficulties that lie in our path. 2. Self-judgments. Our minds point out all the ways in which we're not up to the task. 3. Comparisons. Our minds compare us unfavorably to others who seem to do it better, have more talent, or have it easier. 4. Predictions. Our minds predict failure, rejection, or other unpleasant outcomes. In Chapter 1, I mentioned Sarah, the unemployed dancer, who said if she had more confidence, she would attend more auditions and dance better in front of the judges. Sarah's mind was